You're listening to episode 13 of Fear the Boots interview series. This episode is the first half of our interview with Tracy Hickman. Running time for this show is 49 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boots interview series. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Chad.
This is Wayne.
And joining us today is Tracy Hickman.
Yay!
Yay, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Tracy, I'm not sure how many people are going to need this, but it's tradition, so we're going to do it anyway. Could you go ahead and give our listeners something of a resume of who you are, where you've been, what you've done? Can you distill 30 years down to 30 seconds?
Yeah, see, we have a saying in XDM, compressing every 60-minute combat by 59 minutes. I'm Tracy Hickman, and I'm probably best known as the creator and one of the co-authors of the Dragonlance series. I was a game designer for TSR, if any of you can remember back that far.
As the official FASA podcast, I will tell you we do remember back that far.
Yeah, I started work there with while Gary Gygax was running things there, and came into the game in the late 70s. My wife introduced me to Dungeons and Dragons.
She's a keeper.
Yeah, I kept, absolutely kept. As a matter of fact, we used my student loan money to purchase our first edition AD&D manuals.
Oh my God.
Wow. That is awesome.
That's if I didn't dedication. Say it enough before, she is a keeper. That is awesome.
You know what? You should write a book about her. Oh, wait, you already did.
You know, it's interesting, too. That was the best use that money was ever put to.
All right, so let's go ahead and ask, what was the major?
I majored in broadcast communications. And I wanted to follow in my father's footsteps. My father had gotten into television back in the 1950s, actually, and had taught communication broadcasting for some time. I grew up, actually, in television control rooms and audio booths. They were a bit different back in those days. We had the great big panel boards with all of the lit switches and the big fader arms that we used to use, and the audio booths were full of carts where you would throw in these 8-track kind of looping tape carts in analog to do the commercials. But that's how I grew up. I grew up around television broadcast, and that's what I was going to be when I grew up. But instead, I was taken away by this whole role-playing game idea, and it's kind of an interesting story how I got into all of that. But these days, it's taken me down this path now, and I'm a world-renowned, I guess, published author. I've been on the New York Times list 8 or 9 times. I've lost track. And we're published worldwide in all kinds of amazing languages, and I even get royalties off of some of those. So it's been a good trip. I am also a lifetime guest of honor at Gen Con, and I think a year or so ago I looked in the program online, and it said lifetime guests of honor Gary Gygax, deceased.
But if he shows up,
he's in.
David Arneson,
and if he shows up,
Tracy Hickman. And ever since then, I've kind of felt on the bubble.
In
lines.
They say death goes in threes.
Goes in threes. Yeah,
man, I'm telling you.
Do you feel endangered?
Don't cross any streets anytime soon.
Yeah. Seriously, do not want to be the lifetime guest of honor.
So you said it was an interesting story how you got into gaming. I'd love to hear it. How did you get into gaming?
My wife introduced me to gaming, and we had just gotten married. We'd been married less than a year. And I was working 3 jobs at the time. I was working as a drill press operator. I was working as a darkroom technician. I was working as a school bus driver. And I was also working as a movie theater manager.
And you were also working without sleep.
No kidding.
It was a long, hard haul. But I was working as this drill press job, and my wife forgot to pick me up. So I rode my bicycle across town and found her where I thought she was supposed to be, which is at a theater. And, you know, I was a fairly newlywed here, and suddenly my wife was taking me for granted and had forgotten where I was. So I showed up at this theater where she was assisting, and she came out and she said, "Oh, honey, I just played the most fantastic game. You forgot me for a game." "Oh, it was this great game," she said, and it had elves and it had magic. And I said, okay. And I had played games most of my life. I was a big Risk fan, and I had even gotten into some early SPI simulation kinds of games like Panzer Blitz and that sort of thing. And I said, "Well, okay, honey," I said, "what's the board look like?" And she said, well, it doesn't have one.
Say what?
I said, well, okay, what are the rules? And she said, well, they're kind of flexible. I thought this sounded like the worst kind of game ever. No board, flexible rules. You just make it up as you go along. What kind of a game is that? But she purchased for me a copy of the Blue Basic set. And if you remember, the Blue Basic set was like one of the original basic D&D sets that was published. It had a hideous cover. And we called it Blue Basic because the rules book was a blue cover. And it was a repetition of the cover art on the box. But they could only afford to print one color on the cover.
Wow.
Blue. Because it was different than the interior black, I can assume. It came with its own set of polyhedral dice, but this was back in the Stone Age of polyhedral dice. Forget Coplos. These dice came, and they were entirely white.
Well, yeah, and you had to take the crayon and color them in. And
crayon, yep. It came in the box.
The crayon came in the box?
Wow.
Yeah. I did not know that.
You had to color the dice in, and then you rubbed the excess wax off, and that's how you read the dice.
Nice.
Yeah, there were instructions for that, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Some old FASA games were the same way. They came with those as well.
And I still have the original dice from that Blue Basic game. But she was going to give it to me for my birthday, which is the end of November, and she couldn't wait. So she gave it to me on Halloween. And I opened the box. Okay, honey. Gee, thanks, honey. That's very sweet. And I opened the box, and I opened the rule book, and within two pages...
Well, wait a minute, just a second. She got you a game that she really, really loved, and then you thought was kind of dumb?
Yes.
Excellent.
It's like
it is marriage.
No, yeah, we've all been there.
It's like when you buy your wife sexy lingerie for a holiday.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, it's a gift for you for her.
Yeah.
Which I'm all for.
Yeah. No, yeah. We all are.
We all are. So I opened up this book, and within two pages of really badly written text, I understood what was going on here. I got the idea, and it just took fire in my mind. I drove out in our little Volkswagen Beetle that night, found a place that was open, and bought my first pad of graph paper. And my wife became a D&D widow for the next 3 weeks. And in fact, I was going to Brigham Young University at the time, and I can still remember sitting in the back of my motivational psychology class, which incidentally was the least motivating class I ever had. And doing nothing but creating this dungeon, my first dungeon in the back of this motivational psychology class. And that was the beginning. That's where we started. It all grew from there.
So you jumped right into DMing.
I did. I jumped right into DMing. And in fact, it's been something of a problem because I rarely get to play. I have rarely gotten to play.
I know my first DM had that same problem. We started playing with him, and he was always the DM and never got to play. And he kind of got burned out on because he wanted to play. And I'm on the other side of that. I rarely GM because I prefer to play. So I hear you.
I'm on the GM side, and you know what? It doesn't bother me.
Well, it's good.
I mean, of course, Chad also GMs a lot. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, within our group, it's become fairly well balanced. But I actually prefer GMing to playing. I get more joy out of creating the world, out of eliciting reactions, building memories, watching people interact at the playground than I do out of being part of the playground.
Yeah, and see, and that's the great thing about role-playing games and the great core of role-playing games, that joy in performance and mutual achievement that you have in creating something together. It's something I think that role-playing games have lost.
I'd like you to expound on that, because before we started recording, that was something that you talked about, is that you kind of feel that RPGs are in a bad spot right now, or you don't like the direction they've headed, I think is maybe a little closer to what you actually said. And I'm curious if you would explain exactly what you mean by that.
Well, I don't much like the way RPGs are going, because in general, they've gotten more and more involved in minutiae and more involved in simulation, as though you could simulate magic, as though you could simulate combat really well. So I come from a time when you would turn the corner and there would be a group of kobolds in the corner, and you really had to seriously wonder if you would survive it or not. We've gotten to the point where we have this whole gamey direction when it comes to role-playing games, where we're concerned about leveling, which has absolutely nothing to do with even the imagined world that we're looking at here. And so I find that instead of having a good time, we're spending way too much time in the minutiae, way too much time in the simulation, and far less time in terms of the hero's journey and in terms of telling a good story and an experience.
I couldn't agree more with you, because I see it as role-playing games should be about heroes, but it's like the fireman who is a human. He's a human being. He puts his pants on just like you do. He's a normal guy, and he bursts into a flaming house, and the flaming house can kill him and all of his buddies, and they burst into the house to save the little girl, and they risk life or limb, and there's real danger there, and his motivations and his story and the girl's story are all really important, and that's a definition of hero, and that's how I think a role-playing game should be. But how role-playing games sell themselves is a different definition of hero. It is the hero who is a hero because he is powerful. He is a hero because he is really, really strong and nigh invincible. And his heroic journey is about finding the bigger and bigger challenges that he can take on.
Well, it's the hero versus the superhero. And the response I've often heard to that point, which I cannot disagree with personally, is some people say, okay, then maybe they're not a fireman, but they do something and they are something mundane all day, every day. When they sit down at a table and have their away time, have their escape time, that's what they want to be. They want to be the superhero, not just the ordinary man doing the extraordinary things.
Yeah, but they're not. And that's the point. They aren't doing extraordinary things. The guy who has the sword of killing everything and the shield of impervious to nuclear attack, these kinds of tank characters are not satisfying ultimately because there's no challenge in them. There's no danger in what they do. And just finding bigger and bigger and bigger challenges is like watching slasher films. Oh, gee, that's a shocking image. And it's a shocking image, but it's only a shocking image once.
Right.
You can't do it again. Now you have to do something that's even more shocking, that's even more over the top, that's even more impacting in terms of its gore. And you become desensitized to that because it's pointless. Superman would be an incredibly boring character. Have you ever considered why there are so many different colors of kryptonite? There are all these different colors of kryptonite, apparently readily available on eBay to any
to any bald man, at least.
Happens to need them for whatever purpose. The reason that they are there is because Superman, without kryptonite, is super boring. Mm-hmm. He is no longer a hero. Heroes are made by the villains that they oppose. And if you have no worthy villain, if you have no worthy adversary and nothing to call into question your survival or the survival of the things that you care about, then there's no conflict. There's no satisfaction in beating up the baby kobold.
See, where I struggle with combat and role-playing games is I have a hard time with the disconnect. Because a lot of times you're going along, you're role-playing, and then suddenly you get to the combat moment. And I've termed the phrase Final Fantasy effect, where I hear the theme song of the Final Fantasy games going right when they go to combat, and everything goes flat and tactical. And it pulls me out of the story and the immersion.
That's because the rules get in the way. The technicality of the simulation gets in the way. This is one of the very reasons why we wrote XDM. Extreme Dungeon Mastery. And we put a role-playing game in XDM. We have a basic role-playing game in XDM, and we have an advanced game in XDM. And the basic role-playing game, the character sheet features my stat. And that's all you get. Just one stat.
Actually sounds like something Chad has been talking about for years. He refers to it as monostat.
Yeah. Your character gets one number that you roll against, and that's it.
And for all those people who really insist on it, we have an advanced game in there as well, and we'll actually give them three stats.
Whoa.
You know, it's a little bit for them to juggle.
Yeah, this is a Richard Garriott level of complexity now.
Yeah, so hero system, this ain't.
The whole point of that is to get out of the mechanics and into the game. Mm-hmm. To get away from the resolution. I mean, the truth of the matter is that all the charts and tables and numbers and rolling, all of that comes down to, do you hit him or not?
Yeah.
And how bad?
And you know what? 90% of the time, the game master and the game wants you to win. All these encounters, all these puzzles, all these challenges, when you sweep away the story and the fluff and the tension, the party is supposed to win because the game master can just kill people. I mean, the game master can just say,
rocks fall, everyone dies.
Rocks fall, everybody dies. I throw something at you outrageously more powerful. Everything is balanced to get as close to, yet still win the combat.
Which is the point of Killer Breakfast. I run Killer Breakfast to kill a lot of characters. People enjoy that. But you're right. The point is either to win or to learn something. I ran a game for my son and a bunch of his friends, and we were running Ravenloft. And they found this woman who was weeping in the upper room of her home. And they found her up here, and they couldn't get her to stop crying. And so they were frustrated with this, and so they threw her out the window.
Hey, wait a minute. I think I've played with these guys before.
And so they threw her out the window.
Tracy, I have to say, before you continue, I really hate gaming stories, and I was starting to phase out there until you threw her out of the window. I am all ears. I am so into the story now.
And so the townspeople form a mob. I mean, pitchforks and torches, and they come to this place to take out the characters. And they do. They burned the house down, killed all the characters. And all these boys were sitting there looking at me at the table like, they killed us? I said, you killed this little lady.
And deservingly so, too.
Deservingly so. And they never quite played the same after that.
When you were talking about the direction of role-playing games, you talked about the minutiae and the gaminess, and I'm going to separate those into two ideas, because I don't know how specifically you meant the word, and that's maybe something we should clarify here, but with gaminess, it seems like in a lot of RPGs, there is a de-emphasis on the story and role-playing, and more of an emphasis on basically recreating World of Warcraft on the tabletop. Would you agree with that portion of my definition of what you said?
Yes, I think so.
All right, so let me then move on to the other part, which is the minutiae, the increasing detail orientation of some RPGs. Now, I'm curious, though, how do you see that in light of the fact that there's sort of a counterculture against that with the Fate system, with Savage Worlds, with things like Amber Diceless, these games that go to the very far extreme and abstract gaming almost to that monostat level?
You know, I think if people are enjoying themselves with that, I think that's great. I'm more of a performance gamer. I like to perform as opposed to roll a lot of dice. And I have a tendency to knock dice over from time to time if I'm not crazy about the result.
My God, it's like listening to myself. I am not a simulationist. I am very much, like you said, a performer, more the soft stuff. And I totally am there right with you. You know, if the dice are not telling you what you want, either stop using dice or just fudge the dice. It's your story. You're trying to tell a story.
That's right. In Extreme Dungeon Master, we have a rule called the rule of cool. If what the character is trying to do is so cool, it doesn't matter what the role is. Just let them do it, because it's just too cool not to do.
Right.
If they want to leap and swing from the chandelier and to the other side of the hall and then do a double flip and take the princess in their arms and then swing down on the banister, sure. I think that's great. Go ahead. If you can play with that a little bit, sure, that's fine too. What I remember is we were developing a product many, many years ago where people would come over for a party. You'd use your video camera and you would make a movie at the party. You'd have cue cards for everybody and they would read them cold. So the performances were just awful. And you would just film the whole thing in sequence, so it was all done in a linear edit. And then in the end of the evening, you'd pop the popcorn and watch the movie. And people loved this. It was a lot of fun. And I can remember this one middle-aged woman came up to me after one of these that we had done for a church group. And she came up to me with a huge smile on her face, and I don't ever remember her smiling before. And she said to me, "Thank you so much for this evening. I wasn't going to come, but I'm glad I did," she said, "because I had forgotten what it was like to play." And by that, she didn't mean play a game. She meant play the way we played when we were kids, when it was like a carefree kind of a thing, when you didn't have to worry about what other people were thinking about of you necessarily. But you took on roles and you just tried different things and new things and enjoyed the moment.
Did you see the old Twilight Zone episode about Kick the Can?
Yeah, can. It's a great example of that sentiment.
I won't reiterate the episode for anyone who hasn't seen it, but if you have the chance, look up a Twilight Zone episode. I think it's even called Kick the Can.
Yeah, it is.
And it's a great episode that covers that exact idea about this feeling of being young and recapturing that carefree sense again.
I was on a flight back from Gen Con a few years back. I think it was after edition 4.297 came out or whatever it was. And there were three guys that were sitting across from the aisle from me. And they all had their books out, their brand new books that they just bought at the convention. And they were all flipping madly through these pages. And one of them said to the other one, "Is there any way to make that spell permanent? I don't know. Can I find it? Is there any way to make this spell permanent?" And they're going through the books, digging through the minutiae in these books that had been given to them. When the plane landed and I got up and got my carry-on out of the bin, I turned to them and I said, "There is a way to make that spell permanent." And all three of them looked up at me, pulled out their books, and said, "Really? Where? How?" And I said, "There's an entire adventure written about that." "Really? Where do you get it?" I said, "You haven't written it yet." And the three of them looked at me as though cauliflower had come out of my ear, as though that were an impossible thought. And that's the problem.
You stumped the fledgling little rules lawyers. They didn't know what to do.
I look at people, like, we have a really great online community on our forums, and every once in a while a thread pops up where they're like, show me your collection, show me your book collection, and there's some people out there where it's like, here's my entire bookshelf, well, here's my wall of bookshelves, well, here's my room, well, here's my basement of bookshelves, all of them like solid double stack deep with all these really great books. I mean, all these really cool role-playing game books, and I look at them and I'm like, I mean, that's awesome, but do you need all that for a role-playing game? Sure, you mine stuff for ideas, but God, do you have to have all of the text, all of those rules, all of that stuff for role-playing?
Well, I think there's two things at play there. One is that the handful of studies that have been done of the mind of a role player mm-hmm. have all pretty consistently shown that we're very tactile people, and we're also big collectors. Mm-hmm. And so that
some of you guys.
Okay.
I'm not the average
role player.
Yeah. My gaming shelf is actually a half bookshelf, and half of it is role-playing games. The other half is cookbooks.
Well, right. Fair enough. But you have to admit that you are on
the far end of a bell curve. Yes, I totally
and so
agree.
The average role player is very tactile and is a collector. And while I certainly am not a hardcore simulationist, you know, I'm not into like Task Force or into...
Well, you don't make spreadsheets about your character.
Yeah. I'm not into hero games or anything like that. But having said that, I am a sort of person where I think I would go a step beyond where you and Tracy are. I do like the game part of role-playing game, because I think it does add some consistency and fairness to it, so that when there is a moment of contention or whatever, it's sometimes a give and take between the game master and players. It's sometimes the excitement of storytelling, because the sword swing that was supposed to connect didn't connect.
It comes down to real basics for me. When I was a kid, we used to play army. Sometimes we play cops and robbers. Sometimes we play cowboys and Indians. But it was role-playing.
Sometimes you'd play doctor, but this is a family show.
It's a family show, and we can't talk about it. But but when we would go out and, you know, we'd go wandering through my neighborhood with our little toy guns, and we'd say, bang, you're dead. Bang, you're dead. No, I shot you first. That is all that a role-playing system has to determine, mm-hmm. is who shot who first. And Han shot first. That's the way it is.
Oh, my God. You know what? That was on the other day, just I think yesterday or the day before. And my son is 4 years old. We were sitting there watching it, and it got to that scene. And my wife and I, we're just up in arms, and we're sitting there lecturing Duncan, saying, now, Duncan, just don't watch this because Han shot first. That's just the way it is. This is stupid. It was one of those things that pisses me off. It really does.
For me, when it comes to gaming, I kind of cut the difference a little bit in that I enjoy the tactile feel of rolling the dice. I enjoy failing. I enjoy coming up with an elaborate plan, and then something doesn't go right. And then I've got to figure out, what am I doing? How am I rebounding? So I like the idea of coming up with cool things and all, but I don't want to miss out that chance to fail.
Why can't you choose to fail?
Well, but I think this goes back to what I was saying of the randomness doesn't allow you to choose. That the randomness guarantees that everyone at the table...
The tyranny of randomness.
Exactly. It is. But I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, because it keeps even the game master surprised. I've played in games where my players have attempted to do something, and if I just was to go with the base probabilities of the storyline in my head, no, that's not acceptable. It's not how story goes. But if they can bust out the dice and do it, I love being surprised by that. I love being challenged by that.
I too love being surprised, and I get surprised by my players all the time, and it takes the game in directions that I haven't planned in ways that have nothing to do with the dice.
But without the dice, the one thing that's left there is, because there is no decision-making mechanic that is mutually binding on all parties, you can still outright reject something you don't want, or outright accept something you do want, whereas the dice is a binding mechanic on everyone. Keeps you from doing that, whether you...
What's wrong with doing that?
Okay, I don't know if I'd quite use the term as black and white as wrong, sure. In reference to having fun.
I think it's cheating you out of opportunities.
That's exactly. For me as a game master, it cheats me out of being surprised.
And being surprised and dealing with failure, both of those things provide us with some of the best moments in games, because you have to improvise, you have to do something different, and that's a great thing. That's a great moment in a game when that happens. Yeah, it's not that everybody needs to succeed all the time. It's that they need to occasionally fail so that they can come up with something new and surprising, yeah, both in themselves and in terms of the game.
You know, there's a term about 80s stockbrokers. I was reading an article, and the article said that they had won so much, they forgot what it was to lose. And so when they would lose in their bets, they couldn't handle it. they would just go crazy, and they would just spend more money, and they'd buy more cars just so they could get that feeling of success all the time. But we can get into an argument, dice versus no dice. I mean, basically, it's the same thing in the end. We're all telling a story. We're just telling it in different ways.
Well, and you know, it's when you mentioned the idea of the rooms and rooms and rooms of role-playing games and books, I was thinking about the rule in the original Dungeon Master's Guide. Buried somewhere in that text. It's an impenetrable text, the original tome. But buried somewhere in there is a line that...
Is it just thick or is it poorly written?
Yes. Well, it's... The truth is that why it was part of a club. If you could actually make your way through that book and understand, you know, there was...
You've earned your stripes.
Yeah, some Kabbalah sort of thing was going on with that. But there's a line in there that Gary wrote that says, no matter what else is written in the rules, what the dungeon master says trumps everything else. If you think carefully about that statement, what have they sold us? Because
if
that trumps everything else, why do I need all of these books? Mm-hmm. I can just go ahead and trump.
Even with all the rules and all the dice and all the deciding elements, a game master can still be a dick. He has ultimate control. Even if it's, well, I'm going to do something outside the rules to make this not random and not fun, he could even work within the rules because he is the final arbiter, and he throws the monster at you. He throws the traps at you. He presents the world to you, and he can make it to where it's not random. You are going to win the fight because he wants you to win the fight. You're going to lose the fight because he wants you to lose the fight. Same exact thing can happen in a diceless, indie, weird, high concept system as well. And it gets down to not dice or having dice or thick rules or not thick rules. It comes down to, do you have a good game master or do you have a bad game master? Do you have good players or do you have bad players?
Shared social experience.
Exactly.
Which is why we need to do more about that side of the equation.
Exactly. I'm not saying that all rules should be gotten rid of. If you enjoy rules, by all means, play rules. You're not having fun wrong. You're just having fun different from me. That's one of the things that we as a show, as Fear the Boot, have been trying to do for 200 episodes now, is improve that aspect of it. To share our experience of how we have failed as players and as game masters and saying, this is what we screwed up. This is how to improve it. And it really doesn't have anything to do with the system you're using.
Yep, which is, again, why we wrote the XDM book.
I'm going to have to pick that book up and check it out because...
I was actually thinking about grabbing my phone and buying it on Amazon while we sit here.
Let's talk about that XDM book for a minute here. Tracy, am I correct? That's something you co-wrote with your son.
That's right.
That son's a keeper.
Got a whole family full of them. It's great.
I'm curious about two things here, and we can take them in order because I'm presuming this is the order they occurred within. The first is, how did you get your son into gaming? Because there are a lot of people listening to our show that have requested us at some point to talk more about family gaming or bringing their kids into the hobby.
Dan, so, as a father, if they're not into gaming, you send them to their room. That's all there is to it.
Send them to their room until they have played Nintendo.
Dad, I want to join the football team and get straight A's. Go to your room right now.
And the second thing is, I'm curious what it was like co-authoring this book on role-playing, on this shared family hobby with your son.
Well, it was interesting. My son grew up trying to avoid me in terms of my career and my games.
So he was rebelling by playing football?
Rebelling by doing anything except role-playing games.
That's my worst nightmare with my son.
Never, ever would he be caught dead reading my books. It wasn't until he was a junior in high school we actually moved from Flagstaff into St. George, Utah. And first night that we arrived, all of the young men from from the local church came over, picked him up, and took him away. I mean, they just...
He wasn't even a member of that church. They just put a black bag over his head and threw him in a car.
The crazy hazing thing.
Member of our congregation. We knew these guys. But, you know, they knew he was new in the neighborhood. They knew he was new in town, that he didn't know anybody. And being a junior in high school, how rotten is that for their parents to move him then? And they came by and took him away and just took him in. And,
cool.
And they said, so, you know, what's, you know, find out about him. What's it like? And he's, well, yeah, my dad's Tracy Hickman. He like writes books and stuff. And all of them had read my books. And they said, your dad's Tracy Hickman. That is so cool. That is awesome. His stuff is amazing. His books are incredible.
And as any son knows about their father is never cool.
So he came to me later in that week and he said, can I have one of your books? Sure. And he read them and he said, wow, these are really good.
That's awesome.
How well, come you didn't tell me about these before? You know, I think, oh, yeah, right.
I do have to go a little fanboy on you here and say that I actually, my first foray into fantasy literature was your books, the Dragonlance series. I read the first two series and then the Tales series, which are the compilation of short stories. So before I ever read anything else in fantasy, before I even read Tolkien, I had read Dragonlance. And then actually that was also for me getting into role-playing. When we first started role-playing, we were reading these books at the time and we're like, okay, we're playing Dragonlance. We're playing these characters. It's just too awesome. So I appreciate it. I just want to say thank you for all the great memories and everything.
You're such a kiss-ass fanboy. You know that?
I know. I do it all the time, you know.
I love hearing that. I love hearing that because it means that the books are being read. And a book doesn't live until it's read by someone. It's a dormant thing. It has no life in it until someone reads it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite memories is sitting across the table, and I looked up. It was a biker. I mean, the guy was in his full leathers. He was 6 foot tall, 300 pounds. He's huge. And still in his biker leathers, the guy reeked. He had a big, bushed gray beard, this huge beard, and his hair was all splayed out on his head. And, you know, I thought I'm dead. And I look across the table, and underneath his hands, huge hands, he's holding so tightly that he's curled the pages of my book. And I looked up into his face, and he was weeping because this was the first book he'd read ever.
Wow.
Oh, my.
So when
that's powerful.
When we were going to Gen Con, we were stopped at a gas station along the way, and we saw a whole shelf of your book sitting there. And we have the whole debate about, are these out here all the time, or do they only put them for Gen Con? Where's the weirdest place you've seen one of your books? Was that it?
When I was in Paris once, I saw one of my books in a bookstore in Paris. And it was a real surprise because I hadn't written it.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, that resulted in a few letters when I got home. But
you know, you can't trust those French. It's just all there is to it. I steal everything.
You know how you were saying that you really like people coming up to you and telling you that they enjoyed your books, how a book has life? But one of my big regrets is that I was at a convention where Alan Dean Foster was there. And the first novel I ever read in my whole life was Sentenced to Prism by Alan Dean Foster. And I went on to read after that several of his other young adults and novel books, especially the Pip and Flink series. And they had such an impact on me, not necessarily the story, but just the book itself, the reading of it. Reading is something that is really, really important to me, that I really hold dear and I love. And his were the first, and his novels were what started me on that road. And I was telling my friends, like, oh, wow, Alan Dean Foster is here. I can go up to him, and I can shake his hand, and I can tell him this thing, and I can thank him for writing these books. And hell, we had a podcast. We could have interviewed the guy, but I'm hanging out there. He did a book signing, and I was just walking across, and he was talking to a couple of my friends, chatting with him at the end of the book signing. I walked up to him, and I was about to shake his hand, and I just totally chickened out. I didn't say hi. I didn't say anything. And I just chickened out. I thought, man, this guy has so many fans and stuff. And who am I to just say thank you for writing this book? And I chickened out. I never said a word with him. And I walked away. And I have, of course, never had an opportunity to see him since. And that is something that I really kind of regret doing.
Let me say something about it, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
When you have read his book, when you read one of my books, when you read anyone's book, you become their partner. The actual data density in a novel is fairly small. You can easily transmit an entire 120-page manuscript as an attachment to an email, and no server in the world is going to blink an eye. Even a moderate camera can take, in a single photograph, has more information density than an entire book. It just does. The wonder, the miracle of the written word is that it does not live until it is read. And when you read Alan Dean's book, when you read those words, the meaning of the words, the experience of the words, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the reality of that experience all takes place in the white space between the words. That's where that gap, that arc takes place, where your imagination, where your experience, where your understanding fills in that space with the reality of an experience and with the meaning of the text.
That's one of the things I've always appreciated about authors like C.S. Lewis and moving on to a different medium, to movie directors like Alfred Hitchcock. There was something they understood and oftentimes communicated that this was something they were intentionally doing, which is whatever your brain would insert is more powerful than what they can insert. I can write a scary scene, but only you know what your most plaguing nightmare is. I can talk about a grand feast, but only you know what you would actually put at your own grand feast. And both of them in their respective mediums were careful to always talk around details, to kind of set something rolling and say something like, to use the feast example, I think this was actually in one of the Chronicle of Narnia books that said, and they had this and this and this and all the things that you would expect at a great feast. Well, what would you expect at a great feast? He didn't tell you. He just told you to think about it. You know, Alfred Hitchcock, who knew it was oftentimes more powerful to turn the camera away or to show a silhouette than to show some horrific slasher scene. And I'm sure some of that was also the ratings issues and the general tolerances of the day. But nonetheless.
And yet, would Vertigo have been as powerful a film if it had better special effects? Or if we'd seen everything?
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't. Psycho was as close to that sort of thing as he got, and he still managed to turn the camera for us.
Well, you know what? I think of the original House on Haunted Hill, which is not a Hitchcock movie, but the original House on the Haunted Hill, I mean, we're talking like, what, the 50s, black and white. You can see the zipper monsters and stuff. Very, very scary, thrilling movie. It's not a startled jump out and here's a whole bunch of gore they throw at the screen. Scary because it was showing the people and showing the characters scared. It developed the characters and you empathized with the characters. And what were they doing? How were they scaring you? They were banging on a door. The ghost was banging on a door. That's all it was. Well, fast forward to modern day, they remade House on the Haunted Hill with a $10 billion special effects budget and the scariest, goriest monsters in the world. And who cares? It was bad. But the original House on the Hill is truly frightening. It is a really good movie.
Yeah, Tracy, you're absolutely right.
Tracy, I think this is a sort of good segue point to talk about something else, which is being a novelist or a storyteller, I guess we'll put it that way, for reasons that should become apparent here in a moment, but being a storyteller in the age of new media, how has things like podcasting, serial fiction delivery via PDF, the social networking sites, how has all of this stuff affected or impacted what you do?
Well, it's changed the way I do things completely. I have a new project that I'm working on that's online. If you come to dragonsbard.com, which is dragons as in multiple dragon, and bard as in the guy who carries the lute around and sings a lot. If you come to dragonsbard.com, you'll see my response to that. Publishing right now is in a terrible place. Traditional publishing does not know what to do with new media. They do not know how to address the whole ebook issue. They're scared to death of the Kindles and the Sony e-readers and the iPads because they have no idea how to handle those rights and what to do with them. And the interesting thing is that this is very much the same place that Hollywood was back in the 1950s. They'd just come out of the studio system, but the government broke up the studio system, and so they no longer controlled production and the distribution of their films anymore. Worse still, they were faced with television that was a blossoming new media at the time and challenging Hollywood's supremacy in terms of visual media. And so Hollywood didn't know what to do about television. They tried big blockbuster epics, you know, and 3D movies and that sort of thing, and CinemaScope and Cinerama and okay. But they were losing ground to television badly until the late 50s and into the 1960s, independent producers started coming forward because the big studios were no longer a monopoly and there was a void that needed to be filled. And so independent production houses came out and started making films. And they started making films that were a little bit more challenging, a little bit more counterculture, a little bit different, and asked new questions and posed new ideas until eventually Hollywood got wise. And so today, Hollywood has adapted to that. And now the big movie studios are banks who provide money and facilities to independent producers who come onto the site from Amblin Entertainment or from, you know, from any production company and back the films financially and provide them support, but they don't make the films. That's the independent producer. This is the same problem that's facing publishing today. Publishers today are faced with this influx of new media and they don't know what to do with it. What is going to happen, what I believe is going to happen, and why I've gone into the Dragon's Bard project is that independent producers are going to start coming forward. Independent book publishers who are savvy to new media and are going to be able to address people's new media needs more directly and more readily than the publishers are. And eventually the publishers are going to have to deal with independent book production.
And for anyone that's interested in the Dragonsbard thing, we will put a link to that in the show notes. But Tracy, I was wondering if you could explain what you're doing with that, because you have a fascinating model for this.
You know, and I have to say, I'm particularly fascinated by this model because I'm doing something similar without the paid subscription, without the number of fans, and without all the talent. So I'm really curious what made you think to go along this line of a serialized fiction. And like Dan said, if you explained to all the listeners exactly what this model is.
Sure. I actually had a paradigm shift. I'm going to tell you about that first. Then I'm going to tell you about the model. A friend of mine came over and visited our home not too long ago. And he said to me, you know, the book that you have on the shelf is a souvenir. It's not necessarily the delivery method. It's not necessarily how you read the story. But the book on the shelf is a souvenir. It's a treasure of the experience. It's what you put on the shelf to remember where you've been.
You know, I wonder if that's why so many gamers have so many of these books, because to them, it is their souvenir of their games.
Well, I can validate this to at least some degree, because while there are books that I may read again, and particularly nonfiction books that I may reference multiple times or reference portions of, I can tell you right now that just sitting in my living room, looking at the rows of Robotech books or Arthur C. Clarke books or whatever, that as I just look down the spines, I remember that experience.
Yeah,
exactly. And so the physical book can be the souvenir. And this completely changed my paradigm of publishing. And I started looking for a solution to the future. I started looking into the past. And what I came to was Charles Dickens. And Charles Dickens, Great Expectations, Nicholas Nickleby, A Tale of Two Cities, all of those books were written as serialized novels. They were all done as periodicals and released in chapters periodically.
Which was fairly common in the Victorian age in general.
That's right. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Same thing. The Sherlock Holmes novels were written the same way. And so what we've done is we've taken, we call this write like the Dickens, actually. And what we've done is we've taken the Dickensian serial novel and serial novel format and brought it into the modern age. So what we're doing then is that people can come to our website and they can subscribe to my new book. It's not available anywhere else. This story is not being told through traditional publishing. It's just here. And people can subscribe on this website. And what they will receive is they can download the chapters in PDF form. We put a new chapter up every week. They can also download the audiobook, which my wife and I are producing. That's all included in the subscription price. We have a very active forum there where people come. They not only discuss the book, but they tell me where my typos are. And the great thing about new media is I can go ahead and fix those and repost the chapter.
You know, I've actually struggled with that on the serialized fiction I'm doing. I've noticed things afterwards, and I've gone back and redid it, and I wondered how many people have already read this and caught that before I fixed it.
Yeah, but the great thing about this model for us is that at the end of the subscription, after all of the chapters have been released and the audio is out, at the end of the subscription, my wife and I are doing a private printing of the book. We are printing our own hardback books with our own wrap cover, and we will sign and number every one of those subscription books and mail a copy of the book to each subscriber.
Are you planning on making the book available after that to people that didn't subscribe? Another limited run or something like that?
I actually haven't decided. I kind of like the idea of giving something special. Having the fact that it will be the only first edition and it'll be an extremely limited run makes those books very valuable.
And it's my understanding, too, that you're actually writing this while you publish it or while you're putting it out. It's not like you have the whole novel done and you're doing it. So they're actually seeing the experience as you go along.
Exactly. We had an interesting experience a couple of weeks ago when I had posted a chapter, I posted a succession of chapters, and I had made a mistake in the plot in an earlier chapter. And one of our people on the forums wrote in and said, am I the only one who's seeing this? You know, as though the emperor had no clothes. And I went back and looked at that, and I had made a serious, major plot mistake.
So I'm curious, how challenging is it to keep up with this? Are you releasing chapters weekly?
Yeah, I'm releasing chapters weekly. I wrote a chapter yesterday, in the middle of a chapter today. I'm trying to get a little bit ahead of it because one of our themes is fall in love this summer and hold it in your hands by Christmas.
Is there a cutoff date that people need to get out there to pick this up by?
We've issued a cutoff date of September 1st, but we had a break from our printer. in terms of when we had to submit the text to them. And so, especially for your listeners, I think we're going to push that back by a few weeks, just so that they've got an opportunity to come in and take a look at it.
But this is a finite thing. So yeah, if you guys listening are interested...
It's a finite thing. We can't extend it for a very long period of time because we have to go to press with the book. And however many subscriptions I have is the number of books I'm going to print.
So how far along into the book are you at this point?
12 chapters into the book. The outline is for 22 chapters. So we're about halfway. We'll have it ready to go to the printer, but we'll be releasing chapters weekly after that into November or October, and then we'll be shipping the book in November to everyone. We're shipping both domestically and internationally on it. And the story is a fabulous story. We love this story. It's a gentle story. It's a charming story. It's the kind of story that you don't get through, that you don't see in mainstream fiction anymore, because it doesn't have glittery vampires. And
thank you. God bless you.
It has glittery dragons.
No, not even glittery dragons.
What? No dragons? I'm not interested.
It's been a fabulous experience, and the people who have been involved in it have really enjoyed it. And like I say, the story is phenomenal, but it's only going to be whoever subscribes, and we have a limited number of subscriptions. I'm not trying to sell masses of books. I'm trying to provide a treasure to people.
How much are the subscriptions?
The subscriptions are, international is, I think, around 60 because of the increased shipping costs. I believe that there's a normal subscription of 53 for the book, but it includes not only the chapters and the audiobook that goes with it that's downloadable, but the hardback book when it comes at the end. But I'm thinking maybe I should arrange a special price for your listeners. Don't you think that'd be a good idea?
I think it'd be a great idea.
All right. Since I know the publisher personally, I will arrange a special discount just for your listeners.
Why, cool. Thank you.
We appreciate that. Yeah, and we'll happily work with you offline if there's anything special we need to do, like provide a code to them or something or whatnot. But yeah, we definitely appreciate that. And this is going to be a follow-up question, and I don't expect you to give me any numbers you're not comfortable giving, but just in general, what has the response been like to this sort of new media paradigm of fiction publishing for you?
Remarkably good. The biggest problem that we have faced has been finding the audience. Our audience isn't used to looking for us here. You know, they think that they've got to go on Amazon and find me, or they feel like if they can find a bookstore these days, they're not used to looking for me in the new media formats. And it is part of the problem with new media in general, is that the internet is a wide, wide space. And with everybody talking, it's hard to know who's reading. But we've had actually a tremendous response. We had a huge response at Gen Con when we were there. We'd tell people about the project, they'd pull their wallet out and say, okay, where and how? We'd just do it for them.
I'm also noticing you're reaching out to the podcasting community. That's something we've long said we wish the gaming community would do more. It really does reach the market. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you about it, because I heard you on another podcast talking about it.
Yeah. And in fact, it's one of the ways that we have of reaching our audience. There are a lot of people that are out there who would love to be a part of this. There are a lot of people out there. I would love to be a part of this, because when we come down to the wire on this, when this book is finally finished, it's going to be an adventure, an amazing trip for people to be on. And it's a personal journey that they get to take with me. I administer the website personally. I administer the forums personally. I even take care of the sales. I mean, I built the website myself.
This interview has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.